the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 20 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm speaking to Richard Russell. It's interesting what made me want to speak to Richard, because on the surface, you know, he's the guy who is behind Gruh, or one of the guys who's behind Gruh, which is one of the kind of classic ads of, I guess, this century, really. It's amazing. It won everything wherever it went, and really sort of crossed over into being the kind of thing people would just spontaneously sing in cinemas and that kind of stuff. So I kind of wanted to talk about that and the years of Wieden and Kennedy. But what's really interesting about Richard is that his career, I mean, that ad actually happened almost 20 years into his career. And before that, he did some really, really fascinating work. I didn't know Richard that well, but we both went to the same wedding in October, had a few good chats, got on very well. And the more I looked into what he did, the more I found his overall story, as in the bits before Gruh and the bits after, the entire career, to be as fascinating as, you know, the story behind that one ad and that period of enormous success. So what I have done is actually divide his story into two sections, because we managed to talk for an hour on the pre-Gruh time, or the pre-Wieden and Kennedy time, and then another hour afterwards, which I'll put up next week. And as you'll hear, there's some great stories, some great lessons, and a really interesting path towards winning every Grand Prix on planet Earth. So I think there's just a huge amount to take out there. And again, as I usually say, without further ado, here's my chat with Richard. Thanks very much for making the time to chat, Richard.
That is my pleasure, Ben. Absolutely.
Great. I was looking through your website. I rather enjoy it. There's lots of really good stuff on there. And aside from having a really good rundown of your career and lots of your work, I found out that you've done tons of things that I was very much aware of when I was a bit younger. And I think that's really fantastic. So if we start off in your, it says you started at BNP. Is that how it began? And did you go to college before then or anything like that?
Yeah, I did. I was Watford College before that. I thought if it's good enough for Charles Saatchi, it's good enough for me. But I mean, it kind of all kicked off in the classic way of seeing an ad, which, I mean, again, I've been listening to a number of your podcasts, and a lot of people say, oh, well, I saw this ad and went, blimey, who does that kind of thing? Well, that was kind of me. I led a weird double life at school, because all I could do was English. I was sort of top of the class of English for English for 10 years, and shockingly average or just downright terrible at everything else. So all I could really do was write and think a little bit. And then I saw this ad. So I'm about 16, and I see a newspaper ad. I think it's the last time in history anybody actually noticed a newspaper ad. And it was for the youth training scheme. Jeff Stark wrote it. And it had all these words, and they were kind of, they went round. He said, you can't get a job without experience. You can't get experience without a job. You can't get a job without experience. You can't get experience without... And then underneath, the headline said, vicious, isn't it?
Mm.
And I'm looking at this ad thinking, wow, so hang on, that's writing and ideas. Ooh, there's something there. And I kind of did a little research into where these ads came from and what advertising agencies were. And I discovered that creatives didn't have to wear suits and could just turn up in jeans and were paid okay. And I thought, okay, so that's what I'll do. And so I left school, and within 2 months, so this is 1980, within 2 months, was working in advertising, but I did the classic wrong thing of thinking all I've got to do is get into advertising and work my way into the creative department. I joined the agency. I joined Hilton Advertising, and they as a junior production assistant. And again, I think somebody else...
Sean Doyle, I think, said that.
Right, yeah. Junior production assistant. Boy, don't anybody ever do that job. And what was even worse, I was the junior production assistant on Allied Carpets and Williams Furniture. This is not the way you want to be spending your daylight hours. Mercifully, they've let me go, fired me, whatever it was, after 18 months. And at that point, I thought, right, the only way to get into advertising and be a copywriter is to go to a college and get a portfolio together. So I got into Watford, did the 1 year, and then touted the book around. As everybody says, and I guess it's true for everyone, I look back on it now and I really don't think it's very good at all. But somehow, my theory was always, if, and I do think this still holds true, if you're a solo creative looking for a job, you can, there are positions for a solo creative. An art director might be looking for a writer in a creative department. And if you're fresh out of college and keen and seem like, you know, your arse from your elbow, maybe you stand a chance, and vice versa, copywriters and art directors. But if you are a team, well, there is never officially a vacancy for a college team, a junior team. Mm. No one ever rings up a headhunter and says, find us a great team that I'm aware of. But, you know, a great team, age 20 and a half. I don't think it happens. Whereas I thought, hang on a minute, okay, I'm sure I can find an art director who's looking for a writer. And the theory worked. Andy Mackay at BNT. So this is about 85. Wow. Was looking for a writer. So I started working with him.
And, I mean, I've known Andy a bit at AMV, and obviously he had a pretty prestigious career. I mean, about 10 years later, he did 66, was a great year in English football, and I think was CD of Simons Palmer at that point. What was he like in 1985?
Well, he was, people say this about a few people, but I think maybe it does apply to Andy, the nicest man in advertising.
Yeah.
Just the most charming, friendly, unassuming guy, which is why it always seemed a little bit odd to me that, if anything, he was sort of in charge. Was it Simons Palmer?
I think so.
Because I was thinking, God, Andy will have to sort of fire people and let people go. And Jesus, that doesn't sound like him. But at BNP, he was an absolute delight. But it was a very odd time. I was there just under 2 years, and it was a very odd time for me. And I'm not sure Andy saw the best of me. I mean, I was still learning how to do it and stuff. He'd been working for 2 years. And our bosses were, I don't know whether these names ring a bell to anybody, Alan Tilby and Paul Leaves.
They ring a bell with me.
Right. They were, well, you could either call them difficult, hard people, or you could call them really awful human beings. Right. And they made my life a bit of a misery. I never quite understood it. But man, they were hard on me. And I know there's hard in as much as, no, you've had a fantastic education, Tim Delaney, he's hard on everybody, etc. They just seemed to pick me out just to be horrible too. And it kind of made it difficult with our relationship with Andy, because he was earning, blimey, 3 or 4 times what I was. And I knew I was holding my own. I knew I was contributing. But I just got grief from them. And Andy didn't seem to. And yet we were doing the same ideas and ads together. And it kind of spoiled the relationship a bit. So in the end, we decided to split. And we went in to say we want to split up, knowing full well that, you know, this is not a problem you really want to give your bosses. Because what are they going to do? Get 2 people in for each of you? 1 for each? So I kind of knew that something would have to happen, but what the hell? So, you know, we did it. And the lovely Alan Tilby and Paul Leaves let us stew for 6 months.
Wow.
yeah, they didn't say a word to us for 6 months about it. So in the end, I just marched in to see Tilby one day and said, look, I don't know what you're planning to do with us, but I'm not going to do another ad with Andy. Which sounds a horrible thing to say, but it wasn't really meant like that. It was, I've got to force this issue. In which case, he then said, well, I think you can leave, can't you? I went, okay, great. Could you have told me that 6 months ago? But, I mean, even then, I don't know whether this is, I don't think this is foolish. You sort of, I do think you have to be prepared to lose your job. If you're not happy, if you wake up in the morning with a heavy heart, for whatever reason, you've got to move on. So I moved on. Frank Budgeon was there. Ridiculous, really, because I went from BNP to Leo Burnett, which was just a sort of a dinosaur at the time. And, you know, BNP was full of these extraordinary people, Frank Budgeon, Bill Gallagher, Pete Gatley, John Pallant. It was just a who's who. It was kind of doing the best stuff in London. And Frank Budgeon was an absolute diamond when I left. He took me out for dinner, and he said, because I'd kind of developed a friendship with him whereby we went and played snooker at John Webster's snooker club, where one of us pretended to be John Webster when we signed in, because John never went, so we just used his membership. And he took me out for dinner just to sort of say goodbye, because I basically slipped out the back door. I thought, okay, if I'm not really wanted here, I'll just, you know, literally slip out the back door one night. No fanfare, nothing. Not that I'd done anything to deserve a fanfare anyway, probably. And he said, don't worry, you'll be all right. And he said this most amazing thing, and it almost doesn't matter whether he meant it or not. He said, Richard, it's okay. Cream always rises to the top. Which I thought was just such a generous thing for this incredibly talented guy who'd just done Point of View for yep. Guardian with Webster.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just a little short, trousered, snot-nosed squid, and he says that to me. So wonderful stuff from Frank. And just before I left as well, my claim to fame with Frank is that I strongly advised him not to become a director.
Great.
I said to him, look, Frank, you've shot a John Smith sad or two, and they're quite nice, you know, the Arkwright, okay. But look, there aren't many brilliant writers, copywriters. Don't be a director. There's 10,000 of them. Be a brilliant copywriter. Keep being a brilliant copywriter. And luckily, he ignored everything I said.
So weirdly, he predicted your future, because obviously 20 years later, you were doing the best commercial on the planet, and you totally failed to predict his future. I think that's an interesting...
Yes, but even then, Frank knew what was what, and I didn't.
Absolutely. Okay, so you're at Leo Burnett at this... Was it difficult to get in at Leo Burnett? How did that work?
Well, no, it was remarkably easy. All these, that's my memory of it. I teamed up with a lady called Liz Kaminska, who'd come from GGT. She'd lost her job there. I'd lost my job at BNP. We teamed up, and almost within like a couple of weeks, we'd been hired at Leo's. And it doesn't... after about 3 weeks, and again, Frank said, don't go there. Frank Belgian said, you can't go to Leo Burnett. They all just go down the pub at 11 o'clock and don't come back. And he was absolutely right. A lot of them did do that. But it was a job. And Dawson Yeoman. Do you remember her name? Dawson
Yeoman. I do know that name, yeah.
Brilliant writer and creative from CDP days, I think.
Yeah.
He was in charge. He hired Liz and I. And after 3 weeks, there's a bit of a pattern here. Perhaps I'm quite difficult to work with. I thought, this isn't going to work with Liz. Because, you know, we'd only met 2 weeks before. And every single idea she did was very GGT. It was all, look, I think we should get old footage and colourise it. And I mean, it didn't matter what the brief was. And I thought, oh, blimey, I'm afraid this isn't really going to work. And I thought, I thought it's, you know, extremely unfair to go into your boss and say, after 3 weeks, I'm ever so sorry, Dawson, this isn't going to work. So I went in to fall on my sword and to resign. So this whole thing about, you know, you shouldn't worry about leaving places because it'll be okay. You have to have that ridiculous confidence. I went in to resign and said, look, I'm ever so sorry, but it's not going to work between Liz and myself. It's not, you know, again, it wasn't because Liz was wrong. It's just that our styles were just the way we thought was so different. And he said, no, don't go. Even before I could get the words out that I would resign, he said, don't go, we'll work it out. Which was when he teamed me with Neil Dawson.
Yeah, so what had Neil been doing up till then that he was without a partner?
Well, his partner that, because he said, didn't he, in his podcast that he'd come second in a copywriting contest.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and the guy who won, so the prize was a job at Leah Burnett, so they decided in the end to take the winner on, plus the guy who came second to be his art director. And since Neil had been to art college, they said, oh, well, he can be the art director. And the guy who won just decided after a few months, I don't want to do this, I want to go back to Manchester or something. So he'd gone. Very cavalier. Okay. Which just left Neil. So Dawson put us together, which was very smart, and we were together about 18 months.
Yeah, this was just going through your website. I just wanted to bring up the Biactol ad, because I don't know which year that was, but my God, I think I've seen that ad about 500 times. So I watched it again yesterday and was fully kind of, oh my God, it transported me back to what I guess is the late 80s, early 90s, something like that. Or maybe it ran for a few years.
It was 87. Yeah,
87.
We did it in 87.
I even remember, this is the thing I remember about washing it, because when they rub the sponge on the face, I always thought, that's not really a way of washing someone's face, is it? Like, you're not really getting into the face, you're not really cleaning the face, and then obviously Spanx the bottom of pimples and Stephen Fry's VO and whatever. It all came rushing back to me. I was like, oh my God, Richard did this. So how did that one come about, and how come it ran for so long all over the world?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's great that you remembered it. It didn't do anything within the industry. It didn't really garner any kind of attention, but we did feel it was, you know, quite fresh and different. And Procter & Gamble had this thing whereby, maybe you've heard about this, they had a list of 14 ideas that could be allowed.
Oh, right. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was 14. If you didn't show them one of these 14, they would never buy your idea. And one of them, it was things like, you know, torture test or swap or science endorsement or celebrity endorsement.
Right.
So they had a list of 14, one of which was demonstration, product demonstration. And all the other creatives thought, Lee Burnett thought, bloody Procter & Gamble and this bloody 14-point list, to hell with them. I'm not working on them. And I always thought, and so did Neil, well, hang on, if we just do something good that's one of their 14 points, well, aren't they more likely to buy it? So we just went, well, demonstrations. Sorry, some of the best ads ever made are demonstrations. So we just wrote a demonstration. And I love the balls that we had. Once they bought it, we said to the TV producer, we said, okay, yeah, I think Paul Whelan. You should send it to Paul Whelan. And she said, yes, Paul is the best director in London and is probably quite busy and probably. And we went, no, I think you should send it to Paul. I'm sure he'd be interested. And as luck would have it, he'd never shot a spot cream ad. And he said to us, he was a curious chap, because he didn't say, oh, I did this because I loved it. He sort of said, no, I did it because I'd never done a spot ad.
Great.
So we went and shot it, and just very quickly, there was, this is a real sign of the times, as he was shooting it, we couldn't really see any spots. And we thought, well, we can't really do a before and after. If when you look through the camera, you know, when you see it on telly, you can't really see any spots beforehand. So we mentioned to Paul, we plucked up the courage, Neil and I, to go and talk to him. Say, I'm not sure you can actually register the spots. And he said, I think I know what I'm doing, boys. So that was that. Sure enough, in the edit, you couldn't see any spots.
Oh.
So it's like, we go from this to this. And so this was 1987. It took 6 weeks to find somewhere in London, in Soho, that could make the spots appear, because it was just in the days, you know, the infancy of CGI. There was no such thing. It was paint box, and no one could do it without the spots looking like they were boiling, fizzing, until eventually we got somebody to do it. But then it finally runs, and the reason it became this just ridiculously successful commercial for P&G was it was an absolute doddle to either run exactly as it is in other countries. All they had to do was re-record the voiceover.
Yeah.
Because it was just two twins, one of his two identical 18-year-old boys, one of them just washes in soap and water, the other one washes in Biactol. So, you know, it was so simple. Or they could even re-film it, you know, recut. past it, film it again. So for years and years and years, it ran all around the world and became, their most successful global piece of copy. I don't know why Procter & Gamble call it copy, but they do.
Hmm. Just to go back in time a tiny bit, I just wanted to ask you about the Clarks print campaign you've got in on your site, partly because I was reading the interview that Dave Dye put up with Dave Wakefield, and it's in that interview, and I thought, what a strange coincidence that I'm seeing this campaign. And so Dave Wakefield, I assume, was the typographer, but Helmut Newton was the photographer. Did you go on the shoot and meet Helmut?
No, I didn't. No, I mean, I was very glad that Andy and I did do that together. Our time together, like 20 months or something. So we did create something of real worth, I think, together. And even though he was a, shall we say, difficult man, Paul Leaves was kind of brilliant in a way, because Clarks invented the desert boot. I think it was in 1949 or something. Anyway, it was used in the war. The soldiers used it, and then Clarks helped them make it professionally. So everybody was doing all these history ads about the war, and Andy and I thought, and nothing's getting through research, and Andy and I thought, well, why don't we just do something silly and fashion? So we went in to see Paul with the idea, and he looked at them and immediately just said, yeah, no, I like it. Helmut Newton. Yeah, Helmut Newton should shoot these. And we went, okay. And then buttons were pressed, and next thing we know, Helmut Newton said yes. He did it for a fee of £20,000, which in 1986 was quite some photographer's fee. Yeah. So that was a kind of a wonderful time and an odd time. And also at BNP, I sat next in the office next to John Webster, which is pretty amazing when you think about it, to leave college, to leave Watford, and then find yourself sitting next to John Webster. And he couldn't work his tape machine. He had a record player and a tape machine. He couldn't work it. So he used to come into us with records and a cassette. Say, would you track 8, side B, would you? So we would get the sneak peek at the first, the sort of next brilliant bit of music he'd be putting in his next film.
Great. And so going back to Leah Burnett, I don't know if you're now at the Gordons campaign or not.
So I was with Neil for a bit, and we did that by Actolad, and then Giles Keeble took over as ECD from Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
And Giles said to me, would you team with Mark Tutzel? I want you to team up with Mark Tutzel. And I was kind of enjoying it with Neil, and I sort of didn't want to. It wasn't anything against Mark. I was just sort of happy with what I was doing. And I said, no. This is a bit of a recurring theme.
Yeah,
I think,
it is.
In my career. And then 2 months later, or a month later, he said again, Richard, I'd like you to team up with Mark. And I'm slow, Ben, but I do get there eventually. I remember thinking to myself, oh, God, my boss wants me to do this. I think it would be wise. So we teamed up. And one of the very first things we did was a pitch for Gordon's Gin. And we weren't initially on it, but with 2 weeks to go before the presentation, the agency didn't have anything. And they said, would we have a go? So we kind of said to them, we will, but we want you to get this. We want you to book a room in a hotel because we need to go and brainstorm, really crack it out for sort of 48 hours. So they did. After only a morning's thinking, we chucked out the brief immediately, because the brief was just some nonsense about putting fizz into your life or something. And we thought, well, look, at the very least, why don't we just do something insanely branded? Because Gordon's is green. It's famous having a green bottle. So we were starting to think about how to do some kind of idea around green. What client wouldn't like an insanely branded idea, was the thinking, to win a pitch.
Yeah.
I learned a valuable lesson I learned a valuable lesson that day, Ben. Going to the toilet is a very good place to have ideas.
Right.
Because I went for a pee, like, just before lunch or something, and we'd been sort of at a toilet, what should we do? And as I'm standing, and I think it's because when you go for a pee, you're doing something you've done thousands of times, so you're not really, you're paying attention, obviously. But you're not really thinking about it too hard. And you're also staring at a blank white wall in front of you. And it's like your receptors and antenna are just open. You've just got this blank mind. And all of a sudden, I remembered those old, well, it was just a visual joke of a black, a complete black picture, and it's a black cat in a cellar at midnight.
Yeah.
Oh, ooh, yeah, black cat in a cellar at midnight, and it's all black. I wonder whether we could sort of do that for green. So we just went back and jammed out all sorts of silly versions of that. And went back to the agency, and the following day showed it to Giles, and amazingly, the agency went with it for the pitch. I mean, it's the most ridiculous idea. No people, no drink, no nothing apart from a picture of green and some words. And we won the pitch with it, partly because one of the clients, when Giles presented it, would not stop laughing for the remainder of the pitch, of the presentation. She just kept laughing and giggling. So we won it, and then just started making a ton of ads. And I think it was the most satisfying creative mission. Because Mark and I would just close the door and just jam out the stupidest, silliest ideas. He would use an entire green magic marker. He would lever it out of the glass bottle with a scalpel, and then he would use one to cover the whole page, A3 side of paper, and then tick in a load of white type at the bottom, and then he would chuck away the magic marker. Oh, happy days, Ben. And we did 150 ads in 5 years, and then the cinema, because this was back in the days when Spirits only advertised films on cinema, and it was when cinema ads were kind of better than TV ads, because everyone made a real effort, and you could only ever see Spirit ads in the cinema.
Yeah.
We kind of amazed United Distillers by turning it into a cinema thing, even though that wasn't the core of the idea. It was visual first and print. And it only cost £7,000 to make a 60-second ad.
Sure, yeah, they don't look like they were very expensive.
No, maybe this was why it was so wonderful, because it was literally just Mark and I arsing around and making them. We go to a tape gallery, sound studio, and I just go into the booth and just make ridiculous sound effects, knock things around, make silly noises, and do it for four different 15-second sections, and bang, that became our cinema ad, the launch ad.
I was just going to say, the sound effects on the leprechaun one are particularly good. The little sigh that the leprechaun gives, you talking?
Yeah, that was me. That was just me tapping my fingers on the desk quickly, stopping, sighing, and then tapping them again. The sound of me going from different corridors within the maze. And it was ridiculous, but it was wonderful. And the clients, I think this is almost the most important point of the whole thing. If you're lucky as a creative, you find a client that shares your creative vision, creative and strategic vision, and you're just in the same place. And we got really lucky that the guys who ran it, United Distillers, we would go and see them every few months with the latest batch. And we would all just get really excited about it, as would they, because they knew that if we were coming to see them to show them this stuff, it was because we loved it. And we just thought the next few posters were just going to be fantastic. And And it was an absolute pleasure. The curious thing, what is it? I don't know. Because I can't. So awards, the A word.
Yeah.
The industry just did not want to know about them. And I never quite understood why, because I did, you know, you can't ever say something is wonderful, because that's just your own opinion. But you can say this is different and fresh and makes sense. And also, people seem to love it outside. Yeah. You know, I was in a cinema when the launch ad ran, and the last 15-second slug came up, and the audience applauded all around me. They burst into applause, which still sends sort of goosebumps at me when I think about it. So I knew it was good, and it was interesting, and it was different, and it led to lots of ideas, and the posters were, I thought, really striking, and it never gathered any recognition of any kind over 5 years in the UK.
Wow.
At all.
That is amazing, because the two things I was going to mention about this, including the one I alluded to when I sent you a message on Facebook yesterday. Number one is I was obsessed with the cinema in those days. So I went to the cinema all the time, constantly. So I'd see these ads all the time, and I loved them. I thought they were absolutely fantastic for the reasons you just said. They were like nothing else. You had the lovely little twist at the end where you'd hear the sound effects, you'd see the colours, and then you'd get the punchline. And they did always get a laugh, and they were fantastic. So, yeah, I've no idea. I couldn't in any way come up with some reason that would try and explain why the industry didn't go for them. Because I'd think, God, even on BTA, you'd want to give that a bronze for campaign or a silver for campaign or something. Because as a campaign, it's amazing. It goes on and on and on. It's fresh every time. As you said, it's totally branded. But the second thing I was going to mention is when I started in my first job at Y&R in 1996, I was having a chat with my art director about those ads. For some reason, that one of them popped into his mind or my mind. And I went, oh, I wonder, because, you know, I did read a few award annuals and I hadn't seen them. So I said, I wonder if we could find out who did them and track them down. So we were just bored one afternoon, and I don't know how I found out they were Leah Burnett. So I rang up Leah Burnett's. And I said to the receptionist, hi, did you do those Gordon's ads with like the big blocks of green, and they were done cinema? And she said yes. And I said, could I speak to whoever made them, please? And she put me through to someone. I remember having a conversation with one of the creatives, presumably you or Mark, about them, because I said, like, did you do them? And I don't remember the rest of the conversation particularly, but I was just kind of interested and called up the creative. So I don't know if you remember being called up by a random person, or Mark might remember it, or
no,
maybe it's all a weird
sadly,
dream I had.
It must have been Mark. It wasn't me you spoke to at all. And I don't think Mark ever mentioned that to me.
Well, I mean, it definitely happened in my memory, but we're talking about something that happened 20 years ago, and God, I don't know. I was drinking a fair bit in those days because it was the mid 90s and Britpop and stuff. So I don't know. Maybe. But I just to let you know, I really like them myself. And also, what was great about them was, if you did go to cinema as much as I did, the ads were always the bloody same, and it was always the Bacardi fuckers. And always there was an ad for Southern Comfort where it was that, why do fools fall in love? And my God, it was just the most, after the 50th film you'd seen that year, it was the most grating thing ever. But your spots were much more, you know, I never dreaded seeing them. It was always, oh, great, here's another Gordon's ad. So thank you very much for that.
That is fantastic to hear, Ben. I'm tickled now, and I would have been even more tickled, in fact, had I been the one you spoke to when you rang up. Because I just genuinely thought, well, I guess people don't rate this. How curious.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. And all these years later.
We're having a chat about them.
Brilliant.
So that was the late 80s, wasn't it? When was that, like 88, 89, something like that?
Yeah. It started 89, that campaign. And then it got to about 95.
Wow.
And so Leah Burnett was an odd place to be, because because it was kind of a creative's graveyard. Even though I felt that, you know, with Neil and with Mark, we were doing really quite interesting stuff, you just couldn't get anything out that would make the phone go.
Right.
Creative phones never rang from other agencies, you know, saying, hey, would you want to come here? And when I left after 8 years, here's a sobering fact. It was a department of 15 teams, so 30 people. In the 8 years I'd been there, not one creative had left of their own accord to go to another agency in London.
Wow.
Isn't that astonishing? In 8 years, yeah. I mean, Neil and Clive did that amazing thing where they went, listen, this doesn't seem to be happening for us here. Sod it, we're going to South Africa and we're going to put an amazing portfolio together and we're going to come back in 3 years and take over the world, which is just wonderful and ballsy. And they did it, they delivered. Mm. But nobody else had left to go to another. So I thought, and I did not want my 10-year Leo Burnett tie. I just thought, even though I was enjoying myself and I was making lots of stuff, and actually, because you look back now and you go, why did I enjoy it so much? And the answer is because you're making.
Yeah.
You're doing stuff. You're a creative. You know, and my recent life in the industry has not really been as a creative. It's been as a sort of globe-trotting manager, and there's just a world of difference. So it's why I look back on it with such fondness. But even so, I did not want my 10-year tie. I thought it would be a mark of failure, in fact. I don't want to be too cruel about it, but a mark of failure to have been at Leo's for 10 years. So I did the next best thing I could possibly do, which is I went sideways. I went to Dorland's.
Right.
Which was, you know, in a similar kind of bracket, really. To work with Tim Ashton, under Tim Ashton.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting place. I teamed up with a different art director, Carl LeBlond, and we did some fun stuff there. We ran Compaq.
Yeah, there's some great stuff there.
Yeah, thank you. We developed a brilliant relationship with the UK clients, sold in a very different kind of strategy and thought to them, and both did kind of business-to-business ads and consumer ads, and it was good. But then, so this about 18 months later, there was, as happens frequently, and this was my first experience of it happening as a creative director, and how your life and your future and your fate isn't really your own as a CD.
Mm.
It doesn't really matter how well you do your job or how not well you do your job. It's not, you know, you're not in control of your fate. Some people in another country somewhere decided Compaq was going to be globally realigned to another agency, another network. So Carl and I are suddenly out of a job. You know, so when you're running the account,
yeah.
you know all this stuff. When you're running the account, they go, well, hang on, these guys are on a decent salary. Suddenly, well, I don't think we can keep them. But when you're just a creative, when you're just a team doing the work, and getting stuff through, and people like working with you, you're not prima donnas, etc. You shouldn't ever really get fired because there's no reason to. But when you're in charge of something and running it, and then the account goes, it's right, bye-bye, out the door you go.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's great about that campaign is the actual copywriting that's involved in it, because, you know, I think many people lament the sort of, well, I don't know if it's dying in or what's happening to it. If you listen to Dave Dye's chat with Peter Suter on his thing, they were talking about the fact that the press section in DNAD now has more words than it's ever had. And obviously we all read a huge amount online and things like that. But when I look at those Compaq ads, they take me back to a time when copywriting, in inverted commas, was a thing. And whether it was those Epson ads that were done maybe a bit earlier as well by, I think, Kevin Baldwin, it reminded me of that.
Oh, Kevin Baldwin's Epson campaign. I mean, that was one of the things when I was at Watford. I went, one day I hope to be able to do something half as good as this. So I know what you mean.
So, I mean, it's great that you're obviously a creative and a CD, but you're actually a writer. So, I mean, we'll get onto some other writing things a little bit later. But what happened after Dorland's then?
Yeah, well, Carl LeBlond and I went to, and fairly quickly got a job at DMB&B, because we went to do the job that no one else in in London wanted to do, which was to be creative director of Mars. And the thinking was, well, you know, the only way is up. Because you really, I think you'll know what I mean. You really do have to have an absurd level of optimism and naive enthusiasm and energy. And you, as a creative, you just have to believe that everything will be okay. You know, what's not going to be okay if we do, you know, get great stuff on the table and develop a relationship with the clients? You know, why would this not work? So, sure enough, we go to BCDs on Mars. And that we did have kind of an immediate success with Maltesers, who were in a very odd world of ballet dancers and young women who were virtually trying to lose weight. Maltesers ads were like awful Diet Coke ads.
Was there not a campaign then, a break from the norm? Was that Maltesers? Or was that something else?
Oh, God, it might be. I just... that rings a bell. So it could well be. The people in the ads would say things like, chocolate? No, Maltesers.
Oh, that, yeah. It sounds very, very old-fashioned. Even then, it sounds like a 70s ad, really, rather than a 90s ad.
Yeah, probably was originated back then, and it had just ticked over, you know, a campaign idea that was barely worthy of one commercial in the first place and somehow lasted a decade or more. So we did a clever thing, Carl and I do think. We went to the client and said, how would you like a campaign where everybody is eating your chocolate all the time and they are loving it? And if you removed your chocolate, the Maltesers, from the idea, the idea could not work for any other chocolate for sale today. It can only be done for your chocolate. And it's full of people loving it. And they went, yeah, okay.
Yes, please.
Well, we'll have that then. So, again, I do think sometimes you can just be smart with difficult clients. Just because they've never done great stuff, it's because they've been sold the wrong stuff. I'm afraid I have a zero tolerance policy when it comes to blame apportioning. Mm. The agency is always at fault. I know there are terrible clients out there. Of course there are terrible clients out there. It is the fault of the agency if they make poor work for those terrible clients. I just don't think there should be any tolerance and excuses. And I can't say I have lived up to that, those strong words always, because life is hard sometimes. But I do think you can try and just treat your clients like normal people who will understand a good idea if you choose the right one and you talk to them about it properly. And so, anywho.
But I think when you're saying that point, I think it's really interesting because of what happened, say, on Honda. You know, with Maltesers and with Honda, and I'd say with Gordon's Gin, you took things that weren't really that great and made them into something that was really good. And I think that's it. I think David Abbott once said, quality is always possible and always under threat. And I think what your career seems to show to me is that you can take things that are unfancied and make something really, really great out of them. And I think what you're saying there is that if you can do that on brands that aren't so good, then there isn't really an excuse. And it's also our responsibility as creatives and the agency to deliver that kind of work. So I think you're right there.
Yeah, to stand up to clients and to use logic and reason and emotion. And, you know, at the end of every year, clients assess what they think of their agencies.
Yeah.
Even if they don't ever tell you this, they kind of go, so what value did my agency bring this year? They value you more if you caused them problems but showed belief. I promise everybody they value you more because they're only human. Clients are only human. they go, do you know what, they were a pain in the ass for half of the year, but, you know, to be fair, they you know, they knew what they wanted, and they came to me with opinions, and they stood up for things, and I didn't end up feeling that I was going to have to bloody choose the ad because they had no opinions. And so you can make it happen, but it's hard, and I don't pretend otherwise.
I think also it's very interesting that we often don't think of clients as people who are constantly evaluating what we do. I mean, sometimes you have personal relationships with them and that works, and then it's a bit clearer. But I think there are lots of situations where we don't really think of that as happening. And, you know, when I've written a few times about what's depressing about scam advertising is going up to your client and saying, can we run this at 3 o'clock in the morning on Granada Men and Motors to qualify for awards? And what impression that gives to the person who's paying you to do great things for their brand. You go, could we just, what I'm saying really is, we don't think you bought any good work. Please, can you sort of jinkily buy some good work for us that we can win awards on as compensation for having to work on your drudgy old account? I don't think is really a message you want to send to a client, but I don't think we realize when we're saying to clients, would you mind if we blah, blah, blah? Because we don't think of clients as people, you just think clients. And it's just this faceless corporation
somewhere. Absolutely. Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get it. And awards are a whole big two-hour conversation all by themselves. But they have proved, I think, destructive. And just, you know, over the years, as you see client agency trust eroding, really quite markedly and visibly and tangibly, we still haven't got out of this habit of just talking about awards all the time, and still feeling, for some unfathomable reason, that our best chance of awards is with tiny, little, sometimes non-existent accounts,
yeah,
as opposed to getting really turned on as an industry by changing massive accounts, doing really huge, populist accounts so well that they gather recognition from both the industry and consumers and media comment. It's so much more satisfying to do something fresh and successful and rewarding and irresistible for some big account that everybody knows about and makes a lot of work than just this inward echo chamber world of, you know, whooping and hollering if you get a bloody bronze at Cannes for some press ad or some film, as you say, that ran in Grampian or at 3 a.m. I don't get it. I really don't. I always wanted to just do the stuff that was seen. You know, when people would do their portfolios together and they would do little ambient ideas to go with the TV and the print and the posters.
Yeah.
These tiny little ambient ideas, I always think to myself, okay, it's fun, but blimey, the only people who are going to see that are the 38 people who go in that branch of Boots that morning.
Absolutely.
That's it.
Yeah.
They're the only people who are going to see that. Now, it's nice, but I want millions of people to see the stuff I do. You know, I never understood that tiny creation mentality.
I think that's interesting. I think we'll get, maybe we'll have a more complete awards conversation when we get more towards GRUA, because there's some things I wanted to ask you about that. But for I will link to your site when I put the blog up. But in your awards section, the first big chunk paragraph thing is a bunch of examples of things that aren't really awards. They are people applauding in cinemas or whatever else they happen to be. And I think that's, you know, enormously refreshing to see that, you know, the things that awards are measurable. So you can go, I've got 9 bronzes at Creative Circle and this, that, and the other. And it's very difficult to convey to somebody the real feeling and benefit of having someone applaud your commercial in a cinema, but it is a much, much greater effect for the advertising, you know, to have someone, you know, write a spot that time after time when it appears in the cinema, it's enormously appreciated and applauded versus a Creative Circle bronze, when people are doing their what have I done and what are my awards, the Credit Circle Bronze gets in there, and you can't really write massive applause from cinema. So it's kind of weird how we measure the success of what we do and, you know, the reception of our creativity, because there's this one weird measure of eight blokes in a room or eight blokes or four blokes and four women or whatever going, I believe that can be a bronze in Creative Circle, versus literally 300 people applauding what you've done. And the first one is, for some weird reason, given greater, I don't know, significance than the second one. It's a mess.
Isn't it odd? I'm so with you on this. And I think it's maybe everybody's just very insecure. And ultimately, all we want to make sure is we don't lose our job. But as I've, you know, and awards keep you in your job.
Well, they do, as this only sort of the only measurable way of doing things. And if I don't know if you're on Facebook with Mark Denton, I'm sure he'd be very happy to accept your friendship if that was the case. But he did a thing saying he didn't want to, inverted commas, like, as in Facebook, like the BTAA site, because they've stopped reading out the names of the creatives, and so have lots of other ones. And then Ed Morris came in and kind of explained why. I mean, he was president of Creative Circle for a bit, so I think he was saying that they now award way more things because that's more lucrative. You can get more entry fees. People go, oh, I can win more stuff, all this kind of stuff. But it means that the award night is going to run really long unless you remove the names of the people who came up with the ads. And Mark just doesn't agree with that at all, because the point of it is some sort of celebration of what people have done. But awards have become a totally, you know, way out of kilter sort of thing.
What a curious notion, that thing of to so boldly say, well, no, we're just going to have lots more awards, many, many more people will win. And am I missing something here? Doesn't that devalue the merit of winning it?
Well, it does. And you can also go into the Peter Suter chat with Dave Dyer, where they talk about where DNAD has gone wrong. And I mentioned, when I was growing up, we're going into our award chat now. Maybe we shouldn't do this because it's something for later. But I had so much respect for DNAD because it was judged by people I had huge respect for, and it was very, very difficult to get in the book, let alone win a silver pencil. So when you combine those two things, you've got something that people want to go for. If instead you have a jury of people you don't give a shit about, and you have a situation where it doesn't really matter if the awards have sort of happened or not, and they're all international now, and DNAD is chasing the money, you've got a situation where loads of people don't care about it anymore. It's a shame.
You're right, and I it's tragic. I mean, I really do think it's fundamentally changed our industry. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like I want my cake and eat it, because I have a huge problem with awards, but at the same time, I'm going, DNAD isn't as vital as it once was. So it's like, but this is the paradox of it. I haven't got the latest annual. In fact, I'm not sure I've got the last two. It breaks my heart to say I'm not as interested in it. I don't know. I might have to just rethink all this, because I do. I basically think all the UK needs is DNAD.
Yeah.
That's it. Just go back to that remorseless standard that it's set. And because I say to people like around the world, the networks I work in and stuff, look, awards, all you're trying to do is really good stuff that you know stands a good chance of working and is fresh and is interesting and is a good job. It's just a good job. You're trying to do that as often as you possibly can. To hell with awards, that's what you're trying to do. Yeah. And then on top of that, you are also trying to do one of the half dozen pieces of work in that calendar year that the whole of your industry is talking about.
Yeah.
Now, if you can achieve one of those half dozen pieces of work, you don't even have to worry what the hell it wins, because it will simply be verbal currency for brilliance. Yeah. Everyone will be talking about it. So just either do a brilliant piece of work or aim high. But as I said a bit before, this whole bronze at Cannes, and everyone getting very excited. It's flawed thinking.
It is. With Maltesers, it came to AMV, I don't know how long it was after that, because we got all the Mars stuff a bit later on. And the one thing I'm kind of aware of with people on that account is that it was almost entirely given to female creatives to write. Very good female creatives, I must add, who did some really lovely work. But I thought it was kind of funny that it felt like there was this gender thing for an account and a campaign that was written by two guys. Was there ever any feeling that it was a female thing to you, or did anyone bring it up that way?
We were conscious that their main target audience was women, but we always felt it was a pretty unisex idea. Looking back on it, then this sounds like a stupid thing to say. I now realise, of course, that pretty much all the stuff I wrote and oversaw just had women in it, yeah. Women, or maybe women with boyfriends. But I guess it is a female campaign, and it's sort of taken a few turns over the years, where as well as sort of doing interesting rolling things or whatever with it, there are also other subplots and characters that appear. But that the new stuff, the disabled stuff that was done recently, I mean, I just thought that was fantastic. And it is, it's funny, you sort of, these are strange, these chats you have, because they encourage you to talk about your stuff in a way that you wouldn't really do normally, but it's hugely satisfying to have had an idea that is still going, what was it, 20 years later. It's like it feels like the industry never really paid it much attention, and it all sort of went under the radar, that campaign. But nonetheless, it's satisfying. Yeah.
Well, I was going back over my chat with Trevor Beattie, which will be up here by now for other people to have listened to. But he said the same thing about Cats Like Felix Like Felix. He said that ran for 12 years. And again, going back to a measure of success, that is surely 12 years, 20 years of a campaign is surely better than a Creative Circle prompt, even if the industry didn't award it.
I totally agree. And even if individual executions don't necessarily live long in the memory, there was a look and a feel to that campaign,
yeah,
as well as an end line. In recent years, I look at employed a lot of freelancers, and I look at a lot of portfolios. Is this an uncharitable comment? I don't know. I find it quite striking how so many portfolios don't have, and websites don't really have very many campaign-originated ideas.
Right.
They are individual executions in either other people's campaigns or just individual ideas. And some of them are truly amazing, but you very rarely see a piece of work or a series of ads where you go, wow, okay, God, you kicked that off, did you? Blimey. Good on you. I don't know. I think perhaps it's a harder thing to do, maybe.
Yeah, probably. So we're about 1997, late 90s here in your timeline?
Yeah, so DMB&B, so Carl left to be a director. He was my art director there, leaving me by myself. And I think I've been a bit of a pain to the management, insisting things done a certain way and stuff. And I remember my ECD, who will remain nameless, came to me and said, so what's your plan then, Richard, now that Carl's moving on? And I kind of wanted to leave at this point, so I knew what my answer should be. So I said, well, I'm really looking forward to pushing on, just, you know, working by myself and really giving it a go. And so sure enough, within a week, I was fired. Because I just, you know, they didn't want me to stay. And these are stuff that doesn't really get talked about very often. But you won't always work for good people who share your ambitions and your visions. And you just won't. You will work in places where the chemistry is just not there. And again, it's okay. I know I sort of keep saying this, but if you sort of, the trouble is with my sort of CV is I've been kicked out of half the places I've ever been to, and never cared a jot, because I was convinced it would lead to better things. And maybe most of the time it did. On the other hand, after DMB&B, it was the wilderness year. I became a freelancer, which I think I was a bit unsuited to. I had no idea how to go about it. I was just by myself. And I got two pieces of work in the whole year, two projects. And then I got lucky. You do need a bit of luck every now and then. Neil Dawson bumped into Tony Davidson. And Tony and Kim had taken over at Wyden's about 2 months previously. And Neil just said, "Hey, how are you doing?" He said, "Oh, well, you know, it's, I think it's going to be great, but ooh, it's going to be a bit tricky." And I think apparently Tony said, "You know, the average age of the department's about 16. It's, oh, blimey, it's a bit tricky." And they only had like about four people at Wyden's, because everybody kind of forgets that the first 3 years at Wyden of Kennedy in London was just marked by failure. They weren't doing very well at all. And Neil, bless his cotton socks, said, "Did you know Richard was about? Richard Russell, he's around if you need a hand on anything." So this was after my year of doing nothing. So I most certainly was around. And I went, "Oh, yeah, interesting." Because Tony and Kim and I all started within 3 months of each other at BMP in 1985.
Oh, okay.
So the 18 months I was there, Tony and Kim were there. So they sort of knew of me, but the industry is an incredibly snobby one. And I went down the mines for 10 years. I one minute I'm at BMP starting my career, next minute Clear Burnett, Dawlands, DMB&B. Effectively, you sort of don't hang out with the same people. It's odd.
Yeah.
You hang out with different people, of course, because they're the people who you work with. And I really wasn't a part of the successful industry at all. But they did remember me from the 18 months we were together at BMP. So I went to see them. And I did a smart thing. We had a good chat. And after I left, I thought, okay, I need to do something, some initiative. So I knew it was November or something. And I went, okay, Nike will want a Christmas card. I bet Nike will want to send out a Christmas card. So this is the year 2000. So I went home and thought of a Christmas card for Nike and rang them up 2 days later and said, "Could I come in and show you an idea for a Nike Christmas card?" They went, "Oh, yeah, okay." And they said to me later, many years later, "The reason we hired you was because it was not so much the idea, it was the way you showed it to us," which is quite an interesting, I think, lesson for people. I had this idea about sticking a golf glove, having a golf glove and putting a red ball on top of it. Golf, could you use a red ball in winter as golf? Right. And it basically looked like Rudolph.
Oh.
It was two golf clubs, which two golf clubs became the antlers, you know, spiky antlers. And there was a red ball on the front of a head cover. I had a brown head cover at home, golf head cover, driver. And if you put a ball on the front, it basically looked like a little bit like a Rudolph. But so I needed to balance a golf head cover. So basically, I went in to show them this print ad with all these props. And I pulled out a bit of wood and stuck the head cover on it and then pushed everything else on it. And they said, "It was like you came in and sort of gave a art performance." And we just thought that was ridiculous. So we went, "Right, we'll hire him." They're not a fan of the traditional Tony and Kim.
So. No, not at all. We've got plenty more to talk about, and we've just gone over the hour, And as a combination, I kind of need to get back into my office. What would be great is if this could be part one and we could get together for, without having to rush it and go, oh, let's try and do the whole Nike thing, the whole Honda thing in 10 or 20 minutes. I think between talking about that and other stuff and your book and whatever's happening now, I think we could get another hour out of this personally. And
yeah, I guess.
No, no, it's great. This is all really fantastic. And I think there's just so many pieces of work and so many great stories. And if you've noticed, my Dave Dye thing is still halfway through his career and we've done 3 hours. So maybe I'll just put this one up and you and I can get together and have a chat about, now you've teed up nicely for the Wyden years, and we'll go into that next time, if that's okay.
Sure. Okay. Shall we go away and look at respective diaries?
Yeah, let's do that, and I'll send you another message, and we can just find another hour, because I can definitely make that time to chat again if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rich. It's been a huge pleasure,
and
I really look forward to part two.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. Thanks, Richard.
Cheers then.
Bye.